Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Seeking What They Sought. I'm one of your hosts, Anthony Leiter, and as usual, welcome to the party. Well, here we are again, everyone. Another episode of Seeking What They Sought. And we hope you're doing well and amidst this time of admitted insanity and chaos in the world, as much as well means anymore, right? On today's episode, we actually have something we're really, really stoked to share with you guys. A little while ago, we actually were able to conduct an interview with a friend of ours, Matt Gamble, who used to pastor in Southern California, but has since stepped away from the Adventist Church. And we were able to just sort of journey with him and kind of listen as he chronicled his journey away from pastoring. And kind of the whole purpose of this was sort of to just hear stories of people who have decided to walk away from church in order so that we can kind of learn from their stories and try and be better as we commit ourselves to loving well in the Adventist Church and just be a place of open conversation and listening. So that is what's on the menu today. We're super stoked to share with you guys, and thanks for joining us. All right, let's dive into this conversation. Well, all right, here we are back again. And today, Matt, you're with us. How exciting.
Excited to be here.
So this is Matthew Gamble. We're taking a gamble today. I'm sure you've heard that like a million times in your life. I can't imagine that you haven't heard that.
Wait,
did you prepare that, Jesse? Did you prepare that?
Oh yeah, I've been planning it for years.
Okay.
Is that fresh, Matt? Have you never heard that?
Never heard that one.
Wait, really?
No, very.
That's gotta be a joke.
Very much a joke.
Okay.
Fantastic. Nice, man. Well, so a lot of us, all of us, we all know you just from growing up in similar spaces, but. For those of anyone who's listening who doesn't, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, man? Who are you? Who is Matt Gamble? Where are you from?
Whew.
What is your favorite color? Like, you don't have to tell us everything, but why don't we start with where are you from? Where'd you grow up?
You know, I did the math the other day, and I realized I have moved I'm 45 right now, and I have moved a different state every 3.7 years of my life. But I was born in Massachusetts in Concord, Mass. Lived there till 7, then moved to Atlanta, 7 to 10. Back up to Mass, 10 to 13, and then 13 to 16 in St. Louis, and then St. Augustine, Florida is where I finished high school, and that's where I consider home. My parents are still there in the house I was at in high school, and then actually, my daughter was born there in St. Augustine, and we were looking at pictures today and saw Anastasia Island, which is AKA St. Augustine Beach. And she's like, I lived on an island? And I'm like, yes. yeah, so that's where I call home, consider home. I'm presently living in Northern California, though, just north of San Francisco.
So when people ask you, where are you from, what do you say? Because there's always like where you grew up, but where you...
I call St. Augustine home. That's where that's where I feel home. It's my favorite place on the planet. This actually plays into the story, may come out a little later, but there's a state park that has about 3.5 miles of untouched natural beach. It was meant to be beach. I think in Spain and some areas of Spain, it's pronounced biash. There you go.
So cultured.
Yes. But there's no lights and you're on an island. So it's the north tip of the island. So there's no lights, no construction, and just natural beach. And it's just, for me, I absolutely love it there. I got baptized there in the beach there in St. Augustine, March 23rd of 98.
Nice.
Yeah. So a lot of memories.
So quick question. You started out pastoring right out of college?
I did. Yeah. I started college I mean, it would be a journey to go through my whole testimony, but when I was in high school, I was an atheist, and then just in a nutshell, I was at a wedding at Spencerville, Maryland. My half brother got married to an Adventist lady. I'd never heard of an Adventist before, and I would have been about 19 at that time, maybe 20, and then I went back up to visit them and met with the pastor and just told him I'm seeking, and again was an atheist. I had kind of my claim to fame within Adventism that kind of I think prompted my story is I had smuggled several pounds of weed from Jamaica back into the States, and then that
he was a
led
drug dealer.
Yes, and then that led me on this trip to find God. You know, I just believed that there was a higher power watching out for me, and then met that pastor at the wedding, and then came back some months later and requested to meet with him, and he handed me The Message by Eugene Peterson, and I started reading that thing, and the light came on, and ended up at Andrews studying business management and aviation. But then within a couple weeks at Andrews, I went to BSCF, Black Student Christian Forum, and they opened the floor for testimony, and I had like an out-of-body experience and ran forward and opened my mouth, mentioned Jamaica, the place went buck wild, and mentioned the cannabis.
That's
and,
the way.
And the cannabis comment just silenced the crowd, and then but I quickly changed my major to theology before I was baptized, and yeah, really, whenever I was interviewing and they would ask me, so when did you feel the call to ministry, I'm like, well, I never really chose it. It kind of was a natural progression, and at Andrews got involved with leadership, and then it was called Branch at the time, bringing Andrews to Christ. I think it's like the religious VP, and then got a call to the Washington Conference out of undergrad.
Can I just ask you a quick question? You said that you, after doing the trip to Jamaica, by the way, I'm assuming that you had that crowd on a roller coaster, an emotional roller coaster, when you were telling your testimony. But that you were on your trip to Jamaica, you bring this stuff back, and that you felt like there was a higher power watching over you during that trip?
Yeah, I literally walking through customs in Miami with several pounds of weed on me and a drug dog and not getting caught. That was the defining, that was like in that process of walking with my backpack through customs and knowing that I'm all ML King free at last, I was like, there is somebody watching out for my white backside. And
that's wild.
Yeah.
The funny thing about all of this is, like, what a theological dilemma that poses. Because God is protecting you, keeping you from getting arrested.
Yes.
And yet you come to God. Like, I feel like Christian ethicists would have such a problem debating.
Just a field day.
Sometimes God may look at the bigger picture. Who knows? So,
yes, so.
Yeah.
That's so good. Nice. So you sort of, you know, kind of tracked us through your journey to becoming pastor. We're going to get into this a little bit more. You're not a pastor anymore.
Right.
What are you doing these days?
So it's been a hectic journey. And the last couple, two and a half, 3 years have been hectic. When I say that, I just mean it's been an unprecedented, you want to talk about a roller coaster. It's just been filled with some of the highest highs and lowest lows that I've ever, and quite frankly, the lowest lows have been more recent, in the last 6 months or so. It's just been some of the greatest devastation. But to answer what I'm doing, I basically took a sabbatical last year. I did a 1,000-mile pilgrimage across France and Spain. It's called the Camino de Santiago, if you've heard of it.
My dad did that recently. No way.
Did he? Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a random. I put about 15,000 miles on my car last year driving around the nation and met a guy through a family friend. And a week later, he invited me to go. And quite frankly, I think it was May 6th that we boarded the aircraft and flew and started on May 9th. Last year.
Wow.
And did that for 52 days straight, about 20 miles a day. But when I got back from that, so I've been, you know, again, sabbaticaling, and then when I got back, there's a bit of a story behind it, but in a nutshell, when I moved back to Northern Cal to be close to my kids, I have a 8-year-old and a 5-year-old. I started a consulting and coaching business called Magnetize Global, for a myriad of reasons that name is there. And so what I've been doing as of late is consulting businesses, predominantly in the startup or looking, you know, companies that are looking to level up or innovate. And then I've been doing coaching with individuals as well, which I started coaching during my D-Men. I was introduced to it back in Seattle in about 2005. And then I've been with it ever since, and then added on a one credential I have, another credential I'm applying for right now, just in the finishing stages of that, and really get a lot of, actually receive a lot of personal charge and delight in serving in those capacities. I love innovation, and quite frankly, Pat, what I've been doing is wrestling with, okay, in ministry, what did I really love? Where did I really excel? And what did I bring to the table? And what principles are transferable to the corporate world or individuals, and building with that?
Well, I know for us, like, you were kind of a legend with us. I know you worked with Sean's dad. I didn't gather that from our conversation before. Mm-hmm. Was it directly you worked like at the same church?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Sean, you knew Matt a little bit from that,
Every time I see Matt, it's, you know, I see him like once every 5 years. It's a weird thing, you know, like it used to be in high school, it'd be camp meeting, or, you know, we go all the time to camp meeting, and then I'd see him at like the one project, or I'd see him, you know, it's obviously in the last 10 years or so, very sparse. It's very rare to see you, which is just life when you're growing up. But when he was at my dad's church, I was in like first or second grade, 99, 2000. And my main claim to fame is when I see Matt, I'm like, I knew you with hair. And so that was, yeah, there's a picture. I wish I found it in time. My dad probably still has it. My dad keeps all these random church directories. Mm. And there's probably one from like 99, 2000 when it was you and him at Auburn City over 20 years ago, which is crazy. So
you want to hear something even more crazy about the directory photo is my mom was in town visiting and she's in there with me. So it looks like I'm just this boy man married to this woman that's like, you know, she's standing over my shoulder or something.
That's amazing.
It's ridiculous. But yeah,
that's what we use for the cover art for this episode.
So there she crashed. So she
she crashed your directory photo.
She crashed the directory.
Matt, she did.
I think it was me and Anthony. Eric, were you there? Like, we crashed a church directory at Walla Walla University Church.
Oh, yeah. That was amazing.
they were doing a church directory, and we just went in and did it. We got scolded for it too. So
I feel like I have to say that this quip. The time has passed, but I'm going to say it anyway. Sean, you said that your claim to fame is knowing Matt with hair. I was going to say Matt's claim to fame is knowing you without facial hair, but that's not true because you had facial hair in first grade.
All right. Well, hey, so the reason I brought all this, your history up, Matt, is because you were a legend. Like, you were a speaker that all, like, when we, because we were kids, and you would speak at our local summer camp, Sunset Lake. And like, those are some of the best, most memorable talks that I remember from that time. Like,
Definitely.
I can still remember your talk on Bartimaeus.
Blind Bartimaeus.
Blind Bartimaeus. Blind Bartimaeus. That was class. That was
just
legendary.
Leaning back in your chair and shouting at the top of your lungs, like, Jesus, son of David,
have mercy on me. And he had sunglasses on. And like, and I just want to express this for everyone. So for everyone who doesn't know you, is like, You had this energy, this excitement, this ability to communicate in a way that was just like, it wasn't your typical like, and the Lord said, you know, it was like, it was very energetic, very exciting. And so, and you did, you didn't fit in with Adventist culture, honestly, like your, not just your energy, but you had new ideas. You helped, do you help plant 24/7?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So you help plant like a really contemporary church, in our conference, and so like there was just a lot of stuff that you did that was so different. So I just want to say all of that as a backdrop to why, like, just so people might understand, like, you as a coach now, it makes a lot of sense as you bring all of those things to the table as well.
It's really funny because the other day Matt and I were on the phone and I was telling Matt, like, dude, like, for us growing up in that area, you're like larger than life. Like, you're huge, just like a massive, like Jesse said, like, just wild. Like, as far as like pastors who, you know, growing up we would consider like the cool pastor or whatever, like, you were the epitome of that.
You were it in the Washington conference.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is so, and but to hear that, tell me what you told me, Matt, because that, you know, you said you were oblivious, right?
I mean, dude, the larger than, yeah, I mean, look, gentlemen, let's be honest, we're talking about in Adventism, you've got 20 million people on the planet and probably half of those are not even active, but it, you know, in the whole scheme of things, like, I was oblivious because quite frankly, I mean, this would be such a great topic at some point on or offline. We can, you know, dive into this further. But number one, I jokingly tell people, but I feel like it's a joke, but serious. I'm like, I was a freaking B-level celebrity within this denomination. It took me all over the world. Like
right.
It was just such a... It was awesome. I mean, I was traveling to Australia. At one point, I was going two or three times a year to Australia, and it was just amazing. But this whole larger than life, that was never my, that was just never my experience on a personal level. And I think it was maybe because I had a couple men in my life or people that I held in that, maybe put in that platform or pedestal. For those of you who know Bill Liversidge, he's since has passed, but he came to the Washington camp meeting my first year. I was living as a squatter in a house around the corner. I mean, they knew I was in the house, but I got to stay there free if I mowed the lawn. And Bill modeled for me. I was in a, you know, having internal questions or crises or whatever, and he's like, I'll come by. And he came by and made time. And so I always had, even people like Dwight Nelson or there just were always individuals that made time for me. And so I think that and you know, as a human being, you just know your frailty and brokenness so I think there's a healthy dynamic there that God can keep you in, where you're genuinely humiliated by your own self, so it keeps you humble. But yeah, I was oblivious to this whole larger than life thing, it's when I hear some people, like, I've heard some people say, man, you really helped. You paved the way for me to go into ministry, or being around you inspired me to go into ministry. All of those things mean a lot. I guess the biggest point is I hope that if you saw me in that light, that's on you. But I hope my ego was never like a barrier for a human being, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, man.
I think that's what made it easy to connect to you, Matt. I think you didn't feel like there was a wall in front of you when you were preaching, which a lot of pastors just kind of have. It's like the pulpit is a dividing wall between them and the congregation. You just felt like a person that was talking to other people and just sharing your heart, which it's pretty popular now, but, you know, 10, 15 years ago, that was pretty foreign, especially in the Adventist church. And so, I mean, I was talking with Anthony. For us, that was a huge breakthrough for us. Like, both of, you know, Anthony and I are pastor's kids. We kind of grew up around that area. All of us have here, but that made a big impact on both of our lives, I know, going through high school. And just talking about, like, points of impact, like you talking at camp meetings and seeing you at these different revival meetings, whatever, those made a big difference in our lives. And that was a big deal to us. So, yeah, I would say that you didn't show that ego. It was just, you were just talking, you were sharing.
Well, it's crazy because so now, you know, we've talked you up, we've built you up on this, and now I'm going to bring it all crashing down.
We're just going to destroy
left.
It. <I'm
just> gonna...
You left
no,
us!
Well, I'm curious because you pastored for a while throughout different places. Ended up in, was your last church, was New Haven or Haven?
Yeah, so it's known as, it was formally and traditionally known as Elmshaven. So it's where Ellen lived her last years on the planet. The oldest operating Adventist hospital on the planet is there, St. Helena. It's been there for over 130 years. And yeah, the only two conferences that I ever worked for was Washington Conference out of undergrad and then returned after seminary. And my wife at the time was in med school, and then we went to New Haven, Connecticut. She went to Yale for residency. We moved to Florida for a short spell, and then we both got job offers in Northern Cal, and which we just saw as a God thing. And that, I think we'll get into that piece a little bit. But yes, Elmshaven is the traditional name of the church. It does have a DBA. The signage on the hospital campus, it's kind of my, I'm a bit proud of that. I have to say that it says the Haven Church on there. We just decided to drop the nightmare on Elm Street and just stick with the Haven. It had become a living nightmare. That church was an absolute nightmare. And no offense to anybody, this, because I'm really out of touch, but I've heard it's dwindled back. But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that was the last gig.
Well, what would you say? Where would you say that your story of beginning to walk away from pastoring begins?
You know, so look, I could probably say from day one, I remember I would go to the likes of, I know I've already mentioned Dwight Nelson, but I'd go to the likes of Dwight and say to him, man, I'm really struggling with just basic Christianity. And like, what does it mean to have a relationship with Jesus, right? What does that actually mean? And or let me introduce you to Jesus. What does that mean in actuality? And actually, in your podcast on spirit versus truth, or is that what it was called?
Yeah.
Spirit versus truth.
Yeah.
You guys were hammering that right out of the gate, which I just was like, yes. I like I said to you the other day when I listened, I was like 10 minutes in. I'm like, this is exactly where, for me, I was struggling because I wanted the kingdom to come. I wanted his will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. I believed in a gospel that told me that I would have a new heart and I can use scripture to support a new mind to think with, new eyes to see with. And I just expected issues in my life to fade and that I would become whatever becoming more of a man of God looked like, that would be my narrative. But I can't really say that it was this defining moment. You guys affirm me. It's interesting for me to hear that perspective about the preaching and the style of preaching, but I was really vehemently attacked throughout my Adventist experience, and I don't think I even really came to terms with it until about a year ago, like a year and a half after I resigned. I started having experiences on a deeper level of feeling, and you know, shoot, in the last community I was at, and I will go on record in saying that there were humans that were telling people that I was Satan, not acting like Satan. It was Matthew is Satan. And I'm like, wow. I mean, Lord. But
not even like you were some Catholic infiltrator, but you were actually the embodiment of the devil.
Yeah, there's all that too. And look, I know anybody, you know, anybody that's in leadership, you're going to get attacked, right? We all know that. And again, quite frankly, at the time, I'm kind of laughing, Sean, about your comment about the preaching, because even in Auburn, I had a guy show up at my doorstep with Ellen quotes of, cause I had done some, Indiana Jones, where he steps off in the precipice, and I was reenacting this movie scene and just got hammered, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, but to be honest with you guys, where it really all boils down, where it all boils down is that in my heart of hearts, I was wanting something that I would get glimpses of or I would taste, and I was expecting it to come more, the it being this outpouring of the Holy Spirit. That was really my gospel, as I got maybe more mature in my faith and understood scripture more, my gospel understanding was, quite frankly, I know this may sound crass to some, but there's so much emphasis on the cross, whereas I think Jesus's emphasis is on the resurrection and more importantly, the Holy Spirit pouring out.
We literally talked about this on a podcast about Easter. That's so crazy.
We just talked about that.
The last episode, we just talked about that.
So I haven't checked the Easter one, but I'll check that out. But
no, it's okay. I'm just saying that, like, yeah we're just right lined with
up
you on way, that.
Yeah, just perfectly lined up with what the issue we were bringing up with it. Yeah.
So, you know, fundamentally, and look, I'm well aware, and this is part of what is a bit disconcerting, or it's disconcerting to me, and I'm not really sure what to do with it, but there's a lot of people, when I say a lot, I don't like that phrase. I have talked to a handful of pastors that really resonate with exactly one of my base core struggles, and when I was a pastor, and week after week after week, I'm walking into that pulpit, and I'm a mouthpiece for God. I mean, call it what you want, that you're being paid to get up and feed the sheep. And within Christian circles and within Adventism, it's no exception. It's just so program rich, right? We're all about the event. And so every week of my life, I was in this rhythm where we're putting on this event where God is meant to show up. But then at the end of it, I'm like, what, you know, and I'm not saying just at the end on Saturday afternoon, but I'm talking about week after week, month after month, year after year. I'm like, what is the point? What is happening here? Where is the change here? Because I'll be honest with you, I'm not a big fan right now, and I could deviate on this piece, but I talked very publicly about my experience with pornography, right? Mm-hmm. Well, where is God? I'll just be crass, but it's like, pull out the zapper and change my heart, man. I'm not looking to lose my marriage. I'm not looking to lose my reputation, but I have an issue here where I have this propensity and this draw, and I want to know the power of the gospel. I want to know that. Mm. I want to know it personally. I've preached about it all over the planet. I've seen and I've tasted, and when I've tasted, it is good. But as far as the continuity or the consistency of like a day in, day out, where I feel like, I am friends with Jesus. Whatever that means, I'm telling you right now, I don't know, because it just was not my experience. I wanted it. As I've looked back at my life in a huge cloud of bewilderment, trust me when I say a significant cloud of bewilderment. One thing I do when I look back on preaching, because that was such a passion of mine and such a God-given gift, I felt closer to God preaching than probably any other experience that I've had. I mean, I just felt very void of self in that moment and very used as an instrument in his hand. And yet there's this internal struggles that I've carried through my childhood that I just didn't, I joined Christianity thinking I was getting a new heart. That's what led me to baptism, is that I'm going to be a new man, and I need to be a new man. And the fact is I just didn't, it just was not my experience. It was not my experience.
So Matt, you know, if you, it sounds like what I hear you saying is it wasn't predominantly, or maybe it was, maybe we just haven't touched on this yet, but it wasn't predominantly how you were treated as, you know, that pushed you away. It wasn't, at least that wasn't the tipping point, you know, or the catalyst. It sounds like there was a lifelong struggle or sort of this, that the internal questioning, you know, with your personal faith.
Yeah. It was not a pushing out. Could I sit here and wax eloquent on how things could be improved or whatnot? Sure. But at the end of the day, to be honest with you, I found that the more honest I was with the denominational leadership, I found that to be a good thing. That was my experience, was going and having heart to hearts, come to Jesus conversations, resulted
why
in...
Why is that? Yeah. Why did you feel that was a good thing?
Well, my experience was that it resulted in, quite frankly, it resulted in a lot of grace and understanding. I make up that within Adventism, there's this dynamic that breeds inauthenticity. I think it lends itself, this whole theology of we're the remnant, this whole theology of get over your sins before you get baptized. That alone, that teaching alone of you got to move out of the house, you know, if you're married, if you're cohabitating, split up, if you're a smoker, let's get you to stop for 5 days, then we can dunk you. That whole mentality, it really plays, I believe, is a fundamental issue within Adventism, because now what you have is congregations that in order to become part of a team, they had to get over sin to join it. Now that we're part of it, we don't talk about our struggles. So we just file in.
Yeah.
So back with the administration, my experience was that, I mean, can I be critical towards some of them? Sure. But my, you know, like with your dad, Sean, with Roland, you know, my experience always was that if I was just honest and could go to these guys and tell them, predominantly men, and just tell them, hey, this is what I'm dealing with, this is what I'm up against right now, it led to support. It led to equipping. It led to, I think for me the outcome was positive.
I have a question, Matt. I'm curious if in your sharing those maybe doubts or struggles with those older pastors, did any of them kind of reciprocate or
that's a great,
you know, share some of those struggles?
That's a great question. Not so much, to be honest.
We want
with
names.
You.
We want names and
names and addresses.
Yeah.
Yeah, not so much. But that's, you know, but that's been my journey in life, to be honest. Like I tend to be, I don't know why my prefrontal cortex didn't form as properly or develop as others did, but I don't have the filter that most people do or seem to. And I don't think so my experience through life is that most people are not as willing to be, you know, vulnerable. But I can say that there was compassion that was there. And I'll specifically say, John Freeman, who's now, I think he's North Pacific Union president, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. He was my ministerial director in Washington Conference and then became the president there. But he being one of them, Jim Pedersen here in the Northern Cal, he's since has retired, and Mark Woodson is here. I'm talking about some really hard conversations. And then, you know, especially with Jim, you know, putting him in a bit of a pickle where he had to make some tough decisions, but we were able to work together. So I really admonish people to you know, if they're in a pickle, I know these people, they're in Never Never Land, is what I refer to the Conference Union Division and GC. It's Never Never Land. I mean, where are these people? Like, what have you done for me lately? But when it came time to have those conversations, I did find, I have to give kudos where kudos are due, and I just found a willingness. And I venture to guess that for those brothers in those situations, that it was probably really refreshing, because I venture to guess that they deal with a teetotal, the vast majority of their experience is dealing with all these distractions. You know, what is, I'm not trying to dig all this stuff up, but what is the whole, how many tithe dollars are spent on women's ordination to debate that topic? How many tithe, I mean, imagine how many millions of dollars to fly humans around the planet to debate a distraction, you know, that that's when a guy comes stumbling into the office and dumps his soul out, then they're like, you know what, this is real life. You know, this other stuff is I can't go to any more conferences. I can't go to any more NAD minister. I mean, I just can't do this. But this, now I have somebody who's where this is where the rubber hits the road. And I think, quite frankly, I think that that's what made, if I'm not trying to toot my horn, but I think that that's what made my sermons refreshing, is that it was raw and honest of where I was at in that moment. You know, it was not this is not a song and dance or like a show or program I'm trying to put on. It's, this is where I'm at. This is how the text is speaking.
So I was going to ask Matt, cause you mentioned that you didn't always get it. Like Eric brought up the idea of like, you didn't get that reciprocated, like the pastors wouldn't be, or the conference leaders wouldn't be like, oh, you know what, I've totally gone through that, or I'm wrestling with that too, like, let's pray for each other, let's hold each other accountable. Like, that was not a reality for you. And maybe that's part of a culture too, that I think, you know, I've seen with pastors, even just talking with my dad, part of it is just this idea as a pastor that like laying out your emotion or current struggles with others can be seen as a stumbling block, kind of using that biblical concept of a stumbling block, like, oh, don't become the distraction, like be the kind of this rock of the church where people see like the moral compass of the church, instead of like distracting it with your personal struggles. I don't agree with that fully, and I've always struggled with that when I've heard that concept of, you know, like we, and I joke about it now, but like, when we wanted to go watch a movie, we wouldn't do it in Auburn, like near the we call it the super, you know the super mall.
You would go to another town to watch movies.
So you know the super mall, Matt. So the super mall, like we couldn't go, like we would go somewhere else because it was like, oh, like an Auburn City church member might see us there, and
while they're sitting at the movie theater.
Yeah, we don't want to be a stumbling block. And it was just kind of this idea, like you put on a persona as a pastor's family. And it wasn't about being fake. It was about not being a stumbling block. That was the way that it was perceived. And I know it wasn't just my family. I've talked to a lot of pastors' kids like me that felt like we grew up with that, right?
Right.
So my question to you is kind of looking at all of that, do you think that's why, and maybe if you've talked to other former pastors from the Adventist Church, or when you reflect on your experience, do you think that's why there's a struggle? Do you think that's why there is maybe... for many pastors, kind of this unhealthy way of dealing with their guilt or frustration or their struggles that leads to an unhealthy, an outburst or something bad happens. And you're like, man, how did that happen to them? How did they have this mental breakdown? What happened to this person that I idolized in the church? Like, how was this all going on? And, you know, this isn't even just an Adventism. You can see this in any church.
Sure.
When someone falls from grace. But do you think that's a big contributing factor, is that idea of you need to be that moral compass in the church?
I mean, quite frankly, as you guys talk, I love it because it gives me a different perspective. It's and honestly, Sean, my personal response to what I heard described of the pastor needs to be the rock and can't be a stumbling block. I mean, living under that type of pressure, I just think is unhealthy. I think it's unrealistic. And I also think, I think for me coming into Christianity at 21, I was baptized at 21, and coming in specifically to Adventism, I wanted nothing to do with that. I wanted nothing to do with a facade that I've got my stuff together and you better go get your stuff together if you want to be part of the team. Like, I wanted, you know, I knew the rumors about Christians and how judgmental they could be and this, that, and the other. But then on the flip side of that, my response to what you're describing is that I think that that's actually a very insightful observation and experience that you had that would be foreign to me. It was not my experience. And quite frankly, I think I bucked against it. I also think in my heart of hearts that I would envy if I came around people that I felt were just super steadfast and appeared to have it all together. There would be a level of envy there because I'm like, gosh, I feel like such a fake, because I don't have it together. But I think all in all, from my heart would ache for that person, unless indeed to the best, and your dad, to be honest with you, would come to my mind as somebody who would, you know, Sean, your father would be somebody who, I mean, prim, proper, you know, everything is like put together. The car I drive, right. The clothes I wear, everything is like dialed in. And, but again, my DNA and my experience was very different, but I would have to imagine if there's pastors now, I venture to guess there's a slew of them that would be listening and hearing that and saying, gosh, that's totally me. I don't want to be a stumbling block, so I can't be honest. I can't be authentic. That's where it would lead me if that was, and quite frankly, that's where I see that to be. Within Adventism today, this culture, especially in North America or in our, well, quite frankly, I see it in developing countries as well. There's, when you put people in positions and what the pastor has become culturally, I'm just not so certain that this is what Jesus had in mind with this whole, the profession and then not to fail to mention, I mean, don't get me started on the, when people get up into to the administration land, never land. I mean, it's like, what are you doing? You know, anyway, but that would be a tough burden to live under. I don't want to be a stumbling block for anybody. And I mean, I think you could lead yourself crazy with that.
Yeah. It's hard because, oh, go ahead, Jesse.
Oh, Sean, I was just going to say it's so interesting that your dad was so prim and proper, and yet his son is such a mess. Sorry, Sean, I love you.
Matt did this to me. Like I said, he influenced me very very strongly in high school. This is that's why Anthony and I, because, like, I mean, Anthony's dad to a lesser extent than my dad, but still, like, the traditional pastor, I think, you know?
Yeah.
But we were led astray by Matt Gamble.
I was always, every time I would see you, Sean, with more and more facial hair, I would be, I was so blown away. And quite frankly, it's a testament.
He's only 9.
Right. Because I genuinely did. I was curious as to how you might end up. Right. And the fact that you are in ministry, you're doing your Bible teacher.
Oh, sorry.
Right. Yeah. Or like when we were able to have these conversations at a camp meeting or Walla Walla or whatever, it was very encouraging, right? Because I have an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old, and I'm already telling them that, you know, you're an individual, right? You are your own being, right? But it's inspiring to me to see where you're at, and I'd love to catch up more with you on that.
Well, I was going to say, oh, sorry, Jess.
I was just going to ask a question that we had before, but go for it. If you want to.
That's where I was just going to go back to the story.
I was going to ask, like, you shared that with us that you were recently part of a survey where mm-hmm. pastors were chosen to be interviewed about leaving the SDA church. And you said it caught you off guard emotionally.
Totally.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, I was contacted and they said, you know, we'll send you a $25 Visa gift card if you do this, you know, interview or whatever.
Nice.
And I'm like, absolutely. And you know, I'll do the interview. And so I think it's maybe important to point out, I resigned August of 2017 after an 18-year career of you know, serving the church. And I know we hear this stuff, and I'm not trying to go victim, but I don't have, no one calls, no one, I've seen millions of dollars come through that last pastorate that I was at. I took a dead church. I watched a dead church grow from 30 in attendance to 350 in attendance, and we brought in $2.7 million in 5 years, which may not be much for Loma Linda land, but it was a dump load of money. But my gosh, when I realized that $2.2 million went to Never Never Land, I'm like, this is demonic. And then when I leave, when I resign, because I felt like morally it was the right thing to do, to not hear from anybody, and I can pick up the phone, but and I do from time to time, but it's just like, what is this? Like, what is this? And so in talking to this woman who called, and we did a Zoom conference like this, and she started asking me these questions of what could we have done differently? So the NAD is saying, okay, we're recognizing the pastors are leaving. Why and what could we have done differently? What can we learn? How can we improve? This is a study being done through the NAD ministerial department. And so as she was talking, I was taken aback and being able to share and open my heart up, because look, you're looking at a guy that's 45 years old, not to be Debbie Downer or the victim, but I'm in a funky spot in life where where you guys saw me as bigger than life, and now I can't get a job. I can't get anybody to return a call.
Mm.
So you go from being a B-level celebrity in the Adventist shoebox, and I'm trying to find my way. I'm trying to find my identity. My identity was I was a preacher. I was a pastor. I was an evangelist. I was an innovator. I was a church planter. This is what I do. I'm a kingdom builder. I'm leading people into, quote unquote, a relationship with Jesus or an experience with God or experience with Scripture. So when she started asking me questions of how we can improve or what could we have done differently, as I was sharing this stuff, it was quite frankly, it was blowing my mind at how sad. There was just a deep sadness. And the fact is that, and she even said this to me at one point, she's like, my God, I can see how much you care for this church. And I'm like, well, thank you for pointing that out, because to be honest with you, I'm not the guy hopping online or making websites destroying the church. That's not where I'm at. I have no interest in destroying the church. I have a lot of gratitude for what the church provided for me. I would love if the day ever came, I'm not sure that I would stand by this now, but at my resignation, I was saying, I want to go all Rick Warren and make money and pay back every dime that was ever paid to me. I have a lot of appreciation for the church. I have a lot of human beings, human connections that are my family. I mean, they're quite frankly, me coming into Adventism when I did, I really replaced my biological family, and Adventism became my family. And and so to not have anybody call or say, bro, can I help you out? Or, hey, I know of this, that, or the other that could help you process and land on your feet. None of that was really tough. And then answering these questions just brought up, quite frankly, just a lot of compassion and emotion for pastors that I know that are struggling like I was. And and are in it because the benefits are so good. I hear that ad nauseum. But I can't do this because my son's in college and 70% discount, right?
Mm, right.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And it's yet huge. And yet they're not subscribing to the big picture of the denomination or whatever. And so there's just a lot of hurting. And again, I think a lot of it is just this whole facade we've set up. But yeah, it showed me how much love I have and appreciation for the church. And then, and quite frankly, I think it led me to a place where I realized yet again just how much I wish things were different. I wish things had ended differently, or I wish things were different in my life right now.
Right, Matt,
go ahead, Anthony.
Well, Matt, you sort of talked about this a little bit already, and this was kind of what I was going to ask you. Looking back on walking away from the Haven, you know, after you had, you know, been a part of leading them raise all that money and kind of transforming that space, and then sort of walking away from not only that church but the whole denomination, the whole system, the whole family, like you're saying, that you built. Do you feel like that process sort of solidified in your mind? Oh yeah. Obviously I'm going to, you know, leave this family of people. Do you feel like it aided you in leaving, how people responded to you walking away, how people responded to you leaving, how the church treated you? Or do you feel like, and I'm not trying to lead you in this question, but just trying to drill down, because part of our motivation for doing this interview is, you know, trying to highlight different stories about, you know, people who have chosen to walk away from the denomination in hopes that we can, you know, have an honest conversation and be better and grow and learn and, you know, just be better. And so I guess I'm just curious if, you know, you mentioned you didn't really get any calls back from people or, you know, stuff like that. Do you feel like that solidified you and your decision, or is that just something that you know, kind of brings sorrow to your heart?
I think the latter. I think it's more it's just a layer of sorrow, or because I think the decision was already, it's not I think, the decision was already made. When I announced my resignation, I had my intent at that time, my mentality at that time was that I was going to serve in the church as a volunteer. So that's where my mindset was. And I will be the first to own that I'm in a season of life where, and this is very relevant for me today, I don't trust my discernment right now. I take my time. Instead of making a decision and jumping on it, I give it a few days or a few weeks. I give it counsel. But my decision to leave the pastorate was a no-brainer. And I can tell you the catalyst that led to that, a major catalyst that led to that decision. But as far as the way, it felt icy to me because I had intended that I would be a volunteer, I would preach, I would show up at the church, but there were, you know, there were decisions that I was making that were not congruent within Adventism, and we haven't gotten into some of the specifics of those, and I think maybe it'd be maybe relevant, maybe not.
Tell us a little bit about the catalyst and some of those things that you.
Well, the catalyst was I was speaking over in Denmark in the summer of 2017 at a camp meeting, and And again, you guys, this, there's so much that it's hard to synthesize, and you know how verbose I am. So, that summer, I was already really struggling. Actually, if you guys know Bill Knott, I only knew him from afar, but we shared a little cabin together.
He was a former editor of the Adventist Review, correct?
Is he former or did he recently leave? I thought he was president.
I think he still is.
Yeah, he's still there. Yep.
Huh. I knew at least he had
Jesse spreading fake news.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So he really stood out as a highlight. We had raw, honest conversation. But again, I thought we would be in touch, haven't heard from him since. Anyway, Bill, if you're listening, call me, man. But I returned from that trip. And again, look, there are some nuances that if somebody's interested or they want to call and get into some nitty gritty, I am an open book. I think for the purpose of this, the podcast, I was part of a men's group of some very, I guess it really doesn't matter, but to me it does in a way. These are some very high functioning men, very high influential, affluent men. And we would bring in a therapist, and every 3 times a year we would trap ourselves into a home for 48 hours. And I told the therapist some of what I was going through, and what we would do is just hammer the schlitz out of each other. It's a malt liquor. It was popular back in the day. But we would hammer each other, and the therapist said to me, because I said, you know, I'm looking for something to be spiritual, but there's these other elements that are not happening, and I just can't figure it out. And he said to me, Matthew, anything based on a lie will never be fully spiritual. And when he said that, I got argumentative. Because on the context, I was just in a real frustrated state in my life. And that was Friday night. By the Sunday, that had just hit me between the eyes very heavily. And I'm like, you know what? I'm lying to myself. I'm not Adventist. I'm not nearly Adventist enough to be taking a paycheck. I don't care. My goal is not to make somebody Adventist. I'm not even remotely desiresome to get paid to make somebody, you know, that no. And so I boarded an aircraft, I think that night or the next day. And my wife at the time, who grew up Adventist, we went and took a walk shortly after that. And
sorry, Matt, can I interrupt?
Yep.
Or would you say that epiphany that you had was kind of the main core epiphany of that? Kind of like, you know, feeling like you're kind of living a lie, like, oh my word, I'm not even an Adventist, and I don't care about making other people Adventists. What am I even doing?
It was the catalyst that brought it all together. I think it had been building and building and building. And, I mean, dude, I remember in December before I resigned, sitting with my elders, and I literally sunk down in the chair and tears started going down my face when I realized the money thing. When I realized the 2.7 million and 2.2 mothership had taken. Mm. And I'm like, I told the elders in that meeting, y'all need to either fire me or I'm going to need to resign. Like tears in my eyes. Like, I'm like, this is just, it's, I'm losing my mind. Like I'm losing my mind. And this is so messed up on so many different levels that I can't function in this. And to be honest with you, gentlemen, I really think at a base level, I think being a pastor, this may be not, I just think being a pastor, it's there's a falseness to it, right? And there's this element of we've just created this whole thing. And you're being paid. That's the other piece that really messes it up, where I give much kudos to the Mormons that no one's taken a dime. None of their leaders are taking a dime. And all of our leaders, I mean, think of the nepotism. I bet you everybody sitting here and listening to this knows somebody at the conference whose spouse works at the conference. And I know multiple on that. But anyway, so not to digress, but yes, it was a catalyst that for me brought it all together where I'm like, you know what? I thought I was lying to somebody else, but I'm lying to myself. Mm. I am lying to the core of my being in this moment. Like I'm lying to and that's been the biggest wake up call of it all. Like, it's not a matter of me blaming the church for pushing me out or not doing this or that. Mm. It's me coming to terms with myself and just saying, you know what? If I'm going to call the kettle black, I really, really wish that this was not the case, but I'm just not there. I'm not Adventist enough. I'm not.
Well, Matt, I'm curious because it sounds like there's a lot of facets that we could talk about, but one that you've hit a couple of times is the money thing. And I mean, I know that between the us guys, we've talked about money stuff. I don't think on the podcast really, but we've talked about it ourselves. And just to out all of us, we all hate it. And I can't speak for everyone else. What I can say for myself is that I have always hated the structure of especially what we do with money. Like, and a lot of it, I've seen how it's broken down and all of that. And it's some of it's necessary, some of it isn't. Some of it just seems like it's a poor decision to hang on to stuff that we used to do, that we don't have a good reason to do it very much anymore, but we just keep doing it. The reason I say all of this is because, yeah, you've brought it up a couple of times. It seems like that was a major factor in this. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, I think Sean mentioned that my preaching back in the day was refreshing because people hid behind the pulpit. So it was a different methodology, right? It was a different style. Mm-hmm. And Adventism, as you all well know, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir here, but cultures come and go, right? But I think from my perspective, the way the money is used, it's so backwards, right? Look, if we're gonna be honest, the church should call itself the Seventh-day Adventist Administration. That would be a much more fitting. They're more of an administration, and then maybe there's a second of either church or school, education or hospital, and then church, somewhere in there. But I think they're more focused on administration and preserving their jobs and positions and having all these committees. I mean, what do you need a freaking committee? What do you got to discuss? Like, what is it? What book needs to be written? What video needs to be made? What conference do we have to have? But what happens from my perspective, and this is answering the question of what do I think could change and be different, is that innovation, like you guys, and innovation, the money needs to be funneled into the community and into the local church. I don't believe that anybody cares, or minimal human beings, and I could be wrong here, but I don't believe that many care about the review or the record or whatever your... I mean, how many publications do you receive in a given month that come to your doorstep? And all of our tithe dollars are paying for that, and it does next to nothing to the local context. Mm. What does the conference do? What does the union do? What does the division do for my local context? So when I see this dead church coming to life, I'm begging, screaming, pleading, kicking for funds to invest in the community to see the kingdom continue to expand. But instead, I'm just supporting these freaks of nature, whoever they are,
the framework.
And these humans, by and large, have zero accountability. But as a pastor, my money that's going up to Never Never Land to support you flying around the planet, you and your bride, to go to all these conferences and all these events is actually robbing what you are proclaiming and teaching is the most important thing.
Wow.
Yeah. I was going to say, Matt, hearing you talk, like, it's been in the back of my head for a while. I've actually had some good discussions at my church about it, like the concept of tithing and what's happening in our church with that money. And just like looking at the local church, everything you've been talking about has been on my mind a lot. And I know you're not the only. There's Adventist leaders that have been talking about this for a number of years now. I'm even just going to call out Tim Gillespie, even brought up the idea that there's been a disturbing trend in the Adventist church where administration, now the ratio compared to pastors is what, 2-1?
Less than that is the ratio. Okay. I've heard. It's almost 1-1.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's interesting. I'll have to look up the numbers for that again just to verify.
There was stuff that was put out at the annual counselor? I don't even know the names of any of the stuff that they do. But it was something recently where it was like the GC and they had figures on all of that. And it was, really crazy. Just the unbalanced.
But it almost nature. Like, I almost want to have like, I feel like it's almost like it could be its own discussion. It's just like tithe. What is our tithe doing? And like you're a case study, Matt, like looking at that, like 2.2 of the 2.7 going, like that really bothers me just listening to that.
Yeah.
And thinking like practically what should be happening? Like what would allow churches, local churches to flourish when they are doing the right thing? When you do see God's Spirit moving someone like you that's super passionate, that you see that growth happening, where should we be as a church?
Yeah. And I mean, imagine, because again, you guys, we talk the rhetoric that I think gets people hung up is that we're a worldwide church and a worldwide movement. But at the end of the day, in my opinion, I just call nonsense on that. I call nonsense. Yeah. I call, because at the end of the day, it's all your family that is living down the street and coming to your church. They don't care about the general council session in Texas coming up, where we're going to spend kajillions of dollars to do this whole freaking event to parade ourselves around for what? For what? So at the end of the day, I it's helpful for me, and sorry, I'll get on soapbox and ramped up because I do, this was part of the crisis. I'm like, dude, when I saw 350, and this is not non-evangelistic numbers, I'm not exaggerating. We were consistently at 350 people, and it was me and a part-time secretary, a part-time treasurer, and a part-time janitor.
Mm-hmm. That's insane.
That's wild.
And so, in a very dilapidated old facility that had seats 600 people. Meanwhile, you've got 7 Seventh-day Adventist churches within a 15-mile radius of each other. And it was just a freaking joke. And we're not close. We're like battling one another. And at the end of the day, dude, at the end of the day, it's like, gosh. If my Christian experience were to be whittled down to, I have 5 families that I sit with once or twice a month and we get together and we share life and we actually know each other, I'm good with that. Mm-hmm. And this whole show and everything else, I just can't stomach it. And I'm not trying to be critical but I'm like, I get online, I see everything that's happening on Sabbath Day blows up, and all these pastors are like, here, now I'm on video, and I'm coming to you from my my family room. Well, dude, it's blowing up. Like, very potentially, our churches are going to blow up, and I guarantee you, your administrators are going to do everything they can to keep their jobs, and the further they go up, the less accountability that they have. Because they're never going to fire themselves, as foolish as their position is.
Well, I've told this story before, but there. So, Foursquare Church rents from the one of the churches that I pastor at, and their administration cut their top administration cut several positions at the top so they could keep feeding money back to the churches. And Foursquare churches only give 10% of their money upwards, up the chain. But then on top of that, too, it's pretty interesting, like what you were saying about being the single pastor of a 350-member church. That same church that that rents from that church I pastor, they have two pastors for a church about the same size as mine, which is around 100. They're probably about 120. They have two pastors and a third full-time staff, and like the crazy part is, and they are, you know, they're growing, they're doing really awesome things, amazing things that you just can't do at one pastor. And things like that. So the
and
money
you can't pay, do can, when you're given all that money. I mean, they're giving 10%. You're giving 60-70%.
And so the impact, and what's really cool about their church is, you know, they're a church that's local. Like all of their people are from that area. You know, my church that I pastor there, they're wonderful people. This is not about the people there, but this is Adventist culture where we have people driving 30 minutes because we're the church that has the most contemporary music in the area. And so, and like they love the community too, but I guess that's kind of one of the initial factors. And so it's one of those like hard things to stomach where you're sitting here like, okay, well, I'm glad that our union has a building like it does that is only being half used, but it's this multi-million dollar building. Like, what am I supposed to do? And the reason I bring this up is I don't want to just be railing against, you know, institutions and people, but what you said strikes a chord, and it's so interesting that it was such a, you know, if you're sitting there like, you're going to have to fire me or I'm going to resign, like that obviously isn't just a small contributing factor to you stepping. It sounds like there's a lot more in you in the journey towards that, but that being a catalytic moment, I'm not surprised because it's such a frustrating, it's such a point of continual frustration for me and other people that I know. So that's kind of why I was bringing it up and wanted to know a little bit more about that.
And I was telling Anthony the other day on the phone, like, brother, really consider taking business classes, because one of the things that I was pushing at Elmshaven, which became the Haven, is I'm like, look, we have three facilities that we steward. And the question is how can we leverage any of these facilities that we already have? How can we turn those in to generating operating capital for innovation? I wanted to start. I'm a visionary, right? But you need money to be able to make the vision come alive. And
yeah,
I think, bro. I mean, look, I'm gonna negate myself here and say there's something beautiful about the Adventist Church, about the global collective there. There's something really beautiful about it, and I've experienced it firsthand, traveling again on six continents on behalf of the church. But at the end of the day, we would all agree that it's about the local church, and there's got to be some way that they can start. There's got to be a way in which people that are innovative, that are entrepreneurial, that they can start being empowered to start leveraging these resources that are sitting there. It's low hanging fruit. And if only we could get out of the way and maybe change the rules or regulations a little bit, we could start leveraging these things and bring in money otherwise. Because the likelihood of the tithe system ever changing within Adventism is nine. You know, it's not going to happen. So,
yeah. Mm. Well, tell us. I mean, like, you know, obviously you've been on this crazy journey, but you know, maybe this is a good ending point in our conversation is just like, what's something that, especially from pastoring or even in your journey, maybe it's something from really recently that has just been like really life-giving, really good, aided in personal growth in recent times?
Yeah, I have a few things because I'm not saying this to look for sympathy, but I cannot find words to describe the hell that I have been going through. And I'm not saying that to sound victim, because I've been here the whole way through. I've made decisions. I've been front row to those decisions. And sometimes I thought those decisions were really good and going to lead me to greater heights. And truth be told, I trust that I won't be in this dark night of the soul forever. But I want to just say a few things. One is I am a part of a weekly every man's group. It's not a 12-step. It's not a faith-based, but it is very based on men getting in touch with their feelings. So there's a check-in. This is how I'm feeling. This is what I'm feeling in my body now. We do a meditation, and then we do a greater share, followed by a checkout at the end. And sometimes we'll do a stretch, like a commitment for that week. But my everyman group has been solid. And I really don't know what I would do without them. Or what I would have done without them, because they've been some incredible men. Meditation and mindfulness has become it just proves to be to keep me a bit sane in the insanity at times of just being still and you know, mm-hmm. the psalm of being still and knowing that I am God. I've really struggled with where God is in all this, of why the why behind this, that if there is a loving God, I identify as agnostic at the moment. That just feels the most authentic thing for me to say, is that I want to believe, I believe there has to be something greater. I've left Christianity wanting, but mindfulness helps me, meditation.
I was going to say, you're a guy who, you quote the Psalms, you speak about church structure with such passion, you speak about, you know, the kingdom of Jesus with such passion, even now in this conversation, but you would still say that your stance towards the whole thing, you know, we sort of traced your journey through spirituality and feeling like you left Christianity wanting. You would still say that you haven't quite figured it out.
100%. I'm, you know, it, as far as, you know, when Jesus said, if you then, though you are evil, this is Luke 11:13, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give the Holy Spirit to those who ask him? And I think I've told this to you, Anthony. It's funny. I've had in the last couple weeks, since y'all like this, You guys invited me on this. I met a neighbor walking a dog, and next thing I know, I didn't mention Adventism at all, and he brought up how his in-laws are Adventist in Calistoga. And then I've been talking to these pastors, a couple pastors that I haven't talked to in ages, just in the last couple days, to be honest. But that gets at the quintessential where I'm like, I feel like an orphan. So I will go victim here. I feel like a spiritual orphan. And if that is the scripture that I gave my blood, sweat, and tears for, that I gave my whole life for, that I gave, it was my everything. It was my everything. But then in return, I was not the man that I thought I was in the marriage. I just did not experience this Holy Spirit that I yelled about, that I yearned for, that I fasted for, that I retreated for, that I studied for, that I preached for, all these things. It just, if I'm going to be honest, it's just not my experience. So somebody says, well, dude, are you open to prayer? Absolutely. 100%. Dude, I want nothing more. When I walked 1,000 miles across France and Spain, that was no easy task. My legs are jacked. I went into every church, not jacked in a ripped way. They're jacked up in a, I'm still limping and having a hard time running around. But I went into every church pleading for the Holy Spirit.
Wow.
And I left that trail wanting. You know, I left that experience wanting. So I'm just being honest with you, not to be crass. I'm not trying to be popular. I'm not trying to be Ryan Bell or, you know, an atheist. As much as I admire Ryan, I don't know him. I did reach out to him recently, but I don't know him real well. But I'm not trying to just be...
For anyone who doesn't understand, Ryan Bell was a pastor in Hollywood, California, who said, I'm going to try being atheist for a year, and then left pastoring and is now an atheist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're not trying to be...
He left
pastoring before the being an atheist for a year.
But oh, yes, gotcha. Right, okay.
Yeah. But yes, I'm not. In other words, I'm ashamed. I mean, I'm not ashamed in the sense that I'm like under a rock. I'm just I would, as I said, I wish the story was different. As I was trying to tell Anthony the other day, you guys put me on a pedestal, or you know, bigger than life guy. Well, I'm not happy with how things ended up at the Haven. All I wanted to do is see that church grow. I thought I resigned at a high note, and I thought that church was going to continue to just climb and take off. So I'm bewildered. You know, I'm bruised and battered, and I'm building from the ashes. I'm not trying to be poetic or dramatic. It's just, it is what it is, but
I think it's so important that you in saying this, you're reflecting, especially because we've talked about this with Adventism, where it's this thing where it's like, you know, you're not a sinner anymore because you're a member, right? I mean, like, yeah, we're all sinners, like, yeah, that's a problem, but we don't talk about it, you know, what that actually does. We actually talked about doubt the other day as a group of guys, and just talking through it, it's like doubt is this thing we're terrified of because, you know, it might mean I'm leaving the truth and all that stuff. But I love how you were talking about how I feel these things, and I have to, in essence, what you're saying is I feel these things. I have to acknowledge that I feel them. You know, I can't live a lie. I have to acknowledge that I feel these things, that these are the realities that I am feeling, experiencing, believing. Mm-hmm. And you're being honest about that instead of this, like, continuing on as if that's the nobler thing to do. Mm-hmm. So I just say that I think a lot more people are probably in a place like you, but haven't wanted to admit it for themselves simply because it's so terrifying to do so. And you're not glorifying it either, but you're also being honest.
It's the worst thing on the planet to have. It's awful. I've lost everything. Like, I'm not everything, but I've lost my not in any order, but I lost my title and my position. I've lost my family, my home. I've lost my faith. A couple of years ago, I went on Instagram and said, I don't know why everybody got to call this a midlife crisis. Why not call it a midlife opportunity? Well, I'm waving the white flag and saying crisis is apropos or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's tough, and you know, Adventism has an answer for everything. It really does, and that
or at
also
least we think we do,
or they think. But honestly, that, as Sean was talking about the whole I don't want to be a stumbling block. Well, that's like a blanket that you're going to lay over. I mean, you'd drive yourself crazy if that was your mentality of, I don't want to be, I can't associate with the human race. I mean, I'll just be in my house. I'll show up and preach, and then I'll be in my house. But I don't know, man. I know for... there is shame, like genuine shame or guilt, where I wish that I was saying to you guys, hey, brothers, rah, rah, and champion on. I just have some guilt around it that maybe you guys off record or whatever can help me process through, because I don't want to be, I actually don't want to be a stumbling block. As funny as that is, I don't want to be the, you know, a catalyst to because I just am so perplexed. Like I'm, and I think there's good within Adventism. I just think for me and my life and my journey, I did not see this coming, but I had to tap out.
Mm. Yeah.
I think that's fair. Thanks, man. Thank you for your
honesty. Absolutely.
I think that that was, if we had one goal, you know, throughout this whole thing, it was, you know, just to be honest and listen to you honestly. And the fact that you're so honest about it, I think it really just hits exactly what we were hoping for. So thanks, man. Thank you for just sharing your heart.
And make sure, one last thing I would just chuck in here is make sure you've got, especially for men, that you have, I know Benjamin Lundquist, we raise up leaders that lead, leaders that lead, leaders that lead, make leaders lead, leaders.
Fantastic.
I love Ben and love his heart. And one thing he's been hammering on lately is having mentors in your life, or this, you know, what did he call it? A board of, like, have your own committee, your own board.
Your personal board.
Personal board. So while I can't say that I have that formally, because a lot of that, when I say handful, I'm not exaggerating. Outside of my men's group, I have a few men that I'm in touch with very regularly that know everything. And without them, I think I would be, without those, the men's group and my advisors, my mentors, men I look up to, I really think I would be a dead man right now. Mm-hmm. I think suicide would have been like, I just can't tolerate it. From the dichotomy of where I was to where I am, is just, I can't stomach it. I can't reconcile it. I can't show up for my kids the way I want to. But it's coming, right? And but dudes, I wish you guys all the best, and I wish, please continue to pray for me, man. Like,
dude, yeah.
If, you know, if I tell God all the time, he knows where I am, you know, and if he, and maybe somebody hearing this is going to, can reach out to me and say, dude, you egotistical punk, you missed the point, and this is the key that you're missing. And if that's you, then please, I'm an open book. But man, I just wish you guys all the best. And like, literally, I think there's a, as long as you are in it in an authentic way, even if you have your frustrations and your angst, but authentically you are serving and showing up for people, and people are learning how to love themselves and love God and love their community, I just wish you all the best. And again, I wish I was more the Dwight Kenneth Nelson and just the man of God that he is, and speaking into your life in that regard and not sharing all this, because it's been rough. So, but cheers.
Well, but Matt, thank you again for being honest. Thank you for telling your story and being open like this. And just, again, like, it sounds like it's not the happiest ending, but the reality of why we're having this conversation is to tell a real story.
Yeah.
And it allows us to have authentic reactions to it. So again, that silver lining is we need to be more authentic as a church, as individuals, as leaders in the church, pastors, teachers. We need to do that. We need to have the conversations you had. Mm-hmm. And we need to be the support people for those that want to open up and have, like, you had those experiences. There need to be people in our church that can reach out and support people that are struggling like you have. There are more people out there that are going through those things than we probably realize.
Sure.
And so thank you for sharing that, because it can, and I think it will, reach people that might relate to that. And hopefully it will lead to a healthy conversation and lead to healthy change in their lives.
Mm. Well, Matt, well, thanks again for coming on. I feel like that's probably a good place for us to conclude. I love that. I love where you ended, just honesty, authenticity, and that you can say those things after everything you've been through. You know, thanks, man. Any final words before we close it out? Are those the final words? Did I just say them?
That's good for me.
Nice. Okay. Well, I guess
there we go.
That's a wrap. Well, there we have it, guys. Another episode in the bag. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. On another note, would you actually pause for a second and hit up iTunes and leave us a review? It's actually super helpful for us as we try and gauge how we're doing and what topics are really resonating with you guys. So super appreciative if you guys could go over and do that. Thanks again so much for listening to another episode of Seeking What They Sought. And of course, before we leave, I just want to thank our 17-time Lego Stacking Championship winning producer, Eric Edstrom. We couldn't do it without you. You make us sound pretty. All right, thanks again for listening to another episode of Seeking What They Sought.